Hey, I am super excited to have my longtime friend Marty Schwartz on today. How's it going, Marty?
Great, Jason. Good to be here, buddy.
This is the Protectors Podcast. I never thought I'd be talking to you on the podcast, brother.
It's pretty cool, man. Appreciate that.
It's great. Now, Marty, you have had decades of law enforcement experience.
Over 40 years. As a matter of fact, I'm sitting talking to you. I have a museum at my house that, started. I have a wall with my grandfather who went on to Philadelphia Police Department in 1912 and did 45 years there. My father, who was a career soldier, I've got all his memorabilia in here. And then, of course, I have my own, which is over 40 years of local, state, and federal law enforcement service. So I'm sitting in what I like to call my museum. It kind of puts me in the frame of mind to talk to you, Jason.
Yeah, it's a little bit different. I just hang out on my couch. Everybody else is in these. I hang on my couch and do podcasts. I know it's real professional. But yeah, I took a quick peek at your museum when we were talking before, and man, you got a lot of good stuff there and a lot of memories. I can only imagine what it was like, policing 40 years ago.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because a lot of people like to say, policing has changed, I'm sure we're going to talk about my book here in a minute, but, I write in my book, I argue that policing hasn't changed. I really don't think it has. I think the technology's changed. I think we got some different people in the business today, but I don't think policing has changed all that much. I think it's basically the same job that it was meant to be when it was founded and continues to be. It's public service.
Yeah, I agree. I have to agree with that. Technology has changed, but the same mentality that brings people to become like law enforcement, I think that's always been the same.
When I go somewhere and I see young cops or old cops, I mean, it's like I know them all. They're all my brothers and sisters. They really are. It doesn't matter whether they're in their 20s or they're in their 80s. We share a common bond in law enforcement that it really goes across all ages and all generations.
Yeah, I can only imagine, especially with your family. You probably notice that with the same thing with them. It's like you're probably experiencing the same things they did throughout their careers.
Yeah, when you think about the things that my father talked to me as a boy, fortunately my father, saw me become a police officer and was a big influence in my life and a mentor in so many ways. Because he used to tell the story. He said, he thought his own father was the stupidest person he ever knew, dumbest person he ever knew when he was 18 years old. And when he became 21, he said, I couldn't believe how much the old man learned in 3 years. And that's kind of the thing with my father. He had a career in combat veteran and decided to make a career out of it. And he was just a great mentor to me. But again, when you go back to the essence, when you go back to soldiering, which you're a soldier, when you go back to what is it all about? It's about the other guy, right?
Absolutely.
And that's what policing is all about, right? It's the same thing. Even though we're in different generations, really when it comes right down to it, we're all the same.
Yeah, it's the other guy, and it's that sense of service. And I don't know if it comes from the parents or your upbringing or what, but it's like something that just kind of clicks in you, and all of a sudden you're like, hey, I want to, potentially give my life to our fellow being,
Yeah, it's a funny thing. My grandfather, he was shot as a Philadelphia police officer. And he was shot. I have a newspaper article that was printed in the early 1900s of his being shot. And, you think, wait a minute, we're talking about cops being shot today, and it's crazy, all these cops being shot. My grandfather was shot in the early 1900s twice with a shotgun, and making an arrest. So, again, my father was shot on the island of Luzon, in World War II. So violence has been with us for a long time. And, again, it's evident. It's just more, supportive of what I'm saying. It really hasn't changed that much. What's really changed, and I think we all agree with this, is the real-time news that we're all in that world today, right?
Absolutely.
We all know what's happening even as it's happening, before it even can be studied. And we didn't see that, years ago, and now we do.
It's the armchair quarterbacks that come out in force, Yep. And it's on both sides too. It's like you have your fellow brothers and sisters, you know, criticizing your what you're doing, and then you also have the media and everybody else that watches it.
Yeah,
they only get a glimpse of it.
I read that in the book. You know, some people say, well, you know, if everybody would just listen to the police, you know, some of this would stop. You know, yeah, that's true to an extent. But you know, again, you know, we've been seeing this for years. The difference is now we're seeing it on video. And I also talk about it in the book. And the problem is what you just said, you know, the armchair quarterback stuff. You know, when I look at a video of an officer-involved shooting, you have to remember that the only thing you're seeing is what the camera sees. You're not seeing what's going on in that guy's brain. You're not seeing what he's seeing. You're not paying it. You know, it's just so different to be involved in an incident when your heart rate's up, you know, 160, 180 beats per minute, which is very easily can be. You know, so people need to keep in mind, you know, when you're sitting there, you know, 3 weeks later saying, well, the cop should have done this or should have done that, you know, that's not the reality of what that cop's seeing, or not, oftentimes it's not. Let's put it that way.
Well, you and I have talked, kind of in depth about, you know, the stress and the physiology. Who knows what that cop ate that morning? Who knows if he got a good night's sleep? Who knows if he's had an encounter with this person before? Who knows if he sees something, exactly, he sees something with a 360 view when we're only looking at 30% of the camera view, you know?
Right. Our good use of force investigators, our good officer-involved shooting investigators, and I got a couple of friends that are on a shoot team here in New Jersey. And the good ones know that there are no unimportant facts in an officer-involved shooting. And just the kind of things that you're saying, what time did I go to sleep last night? What was my day like yesterday? What was my day like this morning? Did I have a fight with my wife when I was walking out the door? You know, all of those things can be contributory factors in decision-making and how an officer acts on the street. There are no unimportant factors in a use of force incident.
No, absolutely not. And that's, you know, I still have to read your book. I have to get it. I was kind of waiting for my signed copy in the mail, but I guess we're about that.
Which, you know, there's been a couple high-profile guys around the country that they haven't been bashful to ask for a copy. So, Jason, I guess that's what you just better do is just ask me for a copy, and you'll have it in the mail. You know?
No, I'm really excited because you have such a wealth of experience. You know, I've interviewed you for one of my shows that's coming up, a different show talking about stress and stuff. And, you know, just talking in our careers about, you know, critical incidents and stress management and just policing in general. You are a subject matter expert. So is that the reason, like, you know, you have your 40 years experience, you have your family ties. Is that the reason you put pen to paper?
Or should I say typed it?
Yeah,
exactly, right? So you had guys write books years ago, right, without computers. How did they do it? But, you know, I did it because just what you said, over 40 years, you know, it's never been a job for me. It's been a part of me. It's my profession. It's really, to some extent, not good, and, you know, in the amount of emotional, psychological, physical, everything that went into policing. I gave it all I had because that's what I loved. I absolutely love cops. I love policing. So the reason I wrote it is because I had an obligation to write it. You know, as you know, when you're still working, you know, you can't write. You really can't write what you think, right? You can, but the repercussions are going to be there, right? So, so as soon as I retired, as soon as I had the opportunity to write about some things that I've seen and have been experiencing and teaching and some of the feedback I get from students, as soon as I had the opportunity to write it, it wasn't like, well, I decided to write it or thought this would be good. I felt like I had an obligation to write it. I had an obligation to talk about policing for the sole purpose of trying to help keep cops safe and healthy and the public at the same time. Because really, you know, we don't want to see officers involved in shootings. We don't want to see these violent use of force events. You know, there's a cop that was interviewed in Camden City really recently. And man, and he said, we used to teach, right, so you go home safe, right? That's the only thing that matters. You go home at the end of the shift. He said, we don't teach that anymore. He says, we all go home safe, right? And really, so with all my experience that you just described, I had to write this book. I had an obligation to my profession to give back some of my observations, and that's really what the book's about.
Yeah, and I like that, you know, cops, you know, such as yourself, feds, anybody gets any piece of knowledge that we can get out there that might either potentially save someone's life, de-stress them, give them another, you know, the whole toolkit aspect of it. But, you know, just knowledge. Knowledge is really power.
I had a civil investigator who now is a detective in New Jersey. She's married to a trooper. So they're blue, right? They're blue and blue, the whole family, right? And we came up with, a little story about mentor, you know, the Greek, you know, the story about the name mentor. Who was mentor, right? So mentor was the person that, you know, took that responsibility and passed on the knowledge and taught the next person. And I embraced that through most of my police career. And if you remember, even on the bottom of my emails, it was saying, pass on what you know, because the survivability of our profession depends on, you know, that. It's all about sharing what you know with the next officer, the next person. That knowledge that you keep inside of you absolutely does no good for anybody but you. And that's not what this business is about. And I don't even like to use the word business, but that's not what law enforcement's about. It's not about just me. It's about everybody, officers that I'm working with and the public that I'm coming in contact with.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not knowledge is power, and I hold that power. It's knowledge is it's there to be shared, because
right.
Everybody deserves to know. You know,
right.
You can't – if you have 40 years, you have 5 years, you got a year of experience, but you learn something that could help someone, hey, why not tell them? And that's one thing I like about this world of social media, because now we have people coming out and telling us, you know, you go and you do a video, you do a podcast, you do anything, but you're sharing that knowledge with an audience that's interested.
Right. It's great. Right. And that was the reason I wrote the book. It really was. It's not a book. And, you know, the cops that know me, that have read it, they're like surprised. They didn't, you know, I guess they expected a book of war stories, and it's not. There's a couple stories in there that I interject that I think have a place when I'm trying to make a point. But essentially, it's not a book about my war stories. You know, first of all, they're mostly lies anyway, Jason, most of my war stories. it's really about just what we're talking about here. It's about accumulation of some knowledge and passing it on, and hopefully it might help somebody in the future.
No, it absolutely will. And that's when I'm so glad that you're out there. You're talking to people, and you're not just doing books and podcasts and stuff. You're out there, you know, you're always talking, and I like that. And that's one of the reasons, you know, I kind of really was looking forward to having you on the podcast, is because you have that wealth of knowledge, and now you have a book.
Yeah, you know, and it's you know, we talked about, you know, some of the mental health stuff that we're experiencing, and it's not good. And I'm seeing some really positive stuff when we talk about it, you know. One of the things I just want to get in here with that, because I can't have a conversation with anybody about policing without giving my spiel about mental health.
No, absolutely.
And I want to share this with you. So I respond with a couple teams out here in New Jersey that, you know, when I get a text, the team coordinators will send out a text and they got a job someplace, either an officer involved shooting, there was a bad motor vehicle accident, it was a fire or whatever it was. And, you know, I'm at the point where I really don't want to go, Jason. I really don't want to go on these jobs anymore, but I do. I won't let anybody hang, to stay out there hanging, right, because I know how important it is. But, you know, here's the thing. You know, we like to say that we're immune to all this stuff and, this touchy-feely, this peer support, this critical incident, you know, come on, you know. Well, I just had an occasion about 2 months ago. I got a call from one of the teams that I travel with, and this person is a nurse. She's a nurse practitioner, and she's big in schism. And she had a job at a hospital, a bunch of nurses in the emergency department that had just experienced a really bad incident, a bad one. And she was looking for a team of peers to go, and she just couldn't get the medical people to go. And she called me, and she said, listen, can you go? I said, wait a minute. I said, they're nurses. What are you talking about? I said, you know, I do cops, firefighters, and she said, no, I need you to go. I really don't have anybody, and I know you can handle it. So I went. And what it impressed me is these are trauma nurses, right? These people see stuff that you saw on the battlefield, Jason, that I've seen in the street, and they see it every day, right? They're not seeing it once in a while. They're seeing it every day. And you know what? They said, we need to do a diffusing. We need to do a debriefing by a critical incident stress management person. We want to deal with this now, so we're not dealing with it later. And man, it hit me square in the face. if these people that are the professionals understand the dangers of this psychological trauma, cops, you better wake up. You are not immune to this. You are not Teflon. You know, the way we used to handle it years ago and the way my dad handled combat, those days are gone, man. There's too many people that we're seeing that are tragedies that are a result of what the trauma that they're experiencing on the job. And we've got to turn this around. We've got to turn this suicide situation around. We've got to turn this conduct situation around where guys are getting jackpotted, guys are getting in trouble because of the job, and it's because of the effect the job has had on them. So that's my advertisement. That's my spiel for, you know, for health, mental health and resiliency. That absolutely has to be looked at.
No, and it does. You know, I always forget about the nurse corps and what they must see on it and how they become numb and how we all become numb to, like, you know, not just the blood and the gore, but to the evil and to the stress and to the us against them. And, you know, we really need that peer support because, you know, we talked about this a lot of times before about we really need peer support. We need to be there for our brothers and sisters. And, you know, it comes down to calls and texts and just making sure someone's okay. And that follows on as you do now after your career. You're still there for people, but then people are still there for you because there are going to be days when you're living some bad moments.
Yeah. And you have to know your limitations. I talk about in the book, you know, we used to call it choir practice distance. There's some guys, it's still a term thrown around a little bit, but back in our day, that was choir practice, right? What was choir practice, right? Was after work, you know, there had been a lot happening, and everybody's all keyed up, and nobody's ready to go home, and it was a way for us to diffuse, right? And, all right, there was some shenanigans that went along, and there was too much alcohol and all that. I understand all that, but the bottom line was that was an important diffusing mechanism for those cops, for us, for fire, whoever it was. And, you know, I'm not saying suggesting we should go back to that. What I'm suggesting we do is we continue to do what we're doing with peer support, because the peer support debriefing that we're all involved in now after these critical incidents, that's what it is. It's choir practice. It's choir practice without the alcohol. So.
That's exactly what it is. I think is there a Christmas person in the background?
You know what that is? So you're interested. I just saw all your activity coming back from Germany. So I bought that clock in Bavaria probably 25 years ago. I can tell you this, the Deutschmark was still in effect, so there's no euro, right? So that's how long ago. And it's been in a box. And I said, you know what? It doesn't go in the police museum, but that's where it's going. You know, so I put it in here, and it's just like an added little touch right next to my 24-hour military clock that you've seen, you know, throughout your whole career. So the two clocks are side by side.
No, that's great. We were talking about my trip to Germany. You know, there's a whole other aspect when it comes to, like, you know, interlacing and interacting with our foreign partners. And I can only – that will be season two of the Protectors, you know. I got to start talking to them and see how they deal with everything.
Well, you know, here's the thing. You know, I'm working for this. I'm working for a new company, CGI Global. Actually, CGI Federal is where I'm assigned, and global IT company with a worldwide outreach, a lot of clients all over the world. And we have one of the guys I work with, retired bureau agent. He's also with the CGI, and we're just having this conversation about, you know, how small the world is now, how much the world has shrunk, right? You know, where before it's not across the pond, it's, you know, like it was, you know, it's everything is at your fingertips. It doesn't matter what time zone you're in or where you're at in the world. And if you think about it, right, if you think about going back to 2001, you're still in the Army, and then you're working with Customs and Border Patrol, you know, if we didn't have the Patriot Act back in those days, it was implemented very quickly, that enabled us to do all that networking of intelligence that we did, you know, because the world shrunk on us, right? It wasn't the other side of the world. We didn't have to worry about it anymore. It was here, right? And with the IT, with the IT terrorist capability, we got to be real time with our partners throughout the world.
And that's the thing we're talking about, like how technology changes, but technology brings in more crime, and now it's even more malicious crime because completely collapse infrastructure and everything with a cyber attack. You know, it's crazy.
The human trafficking, right? I mean, that's the tragedy of our time, right? It really is.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, the people's lives are meaningless. They're so they don't mean anything, right? And you know, and that's because of this global outreach facility we have. You know, and you know, I see a lot of great work done in that area. There's a lot more to be done, but I see, you know, we just talked about the Patriot Act, right? So we saw. The reason we were never attacked in this country again on that scale is because the law enforcement agencies got together with the authority of the Patriot Act and made sure that didn't happen. Now we need to use that same philosophy on these traditional crimes, whether it's drugs, human trafficking, internet crimes against children, all these
mm-hmm.
things that we're seeing out there. That the Patriot Act we can't use it, right? But we need to be able to investigate these things on a global scale, just like we did with the Patriot Act, just like we did with counterterrorism. Counterterrorism has been successful. I suggest that we're not as successful in some of these other areas.
No, and it's the interlacing of the state, local, the federal, international partners.
Yep.
Really interlacing it, not just seeing putting a piece of paper and saying, okay, we're good. But, you know, building those relationships at the street level, at the agent level, because, a lot of times it's convoluted when it goes up the flagpole.
Yeah, you've been at all levels, right? And you know, like, you know, everybody relied on Interpol for all those years, right? And Interpol's a great organization. It enables that networking and those contacts and those relationships. I look at Interpol like NATO, right? I mean, those relationships are built and they're solid and they're concrete. But where the rubber meets the road between the agent to agent, things like that, that's where we need to put some time and effort. You know, the structures are
mm-hmm.
there, but the ability for that communication, you know yourself. I mean, what's my ability to communicate? It's if I know a guy that I can call that knows a guy. Really, that's how it works, right? But in this global IT area, world that we're living in, we can be better than that, you know, that's where I'd like to see it's going. When you look at where's law enforcement going in the future, that's where I'd like to see law enforcement go. Not taking away from the street work that we're doing, the great work, the interaction with our public, but, you know, let's take it to the next level. Let's have real information available to that police officer on the street so they can make some solid decisions, you know, and hopefully backed by our government, right, that they're not going to handcuff us, but, like, what we can do, and you know, we can't enforce certain laws and other laws we're supposed to turn our heads to, you know, so... You know, give that officer on the street real-time information that they can use.
Absolutely. Well, Marty, I really appreciate this. Where can we find the book?
Through the publisher, which is Archway Publishing, Amazon.
Okay.
You know, everybody sells everything on Amazon. So
yes.
Amazon. You know, anybody that's listening to the podcast, I'll be at IECP in a couple of weeks. I'd love people to stop by and see. We're going to have... Our booth, Sunflower Systems, will have our booth out there, and so I'd love folks to stop by and see.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Marty, I'm going to post all the links to your social media and all the other good things, and to your book. And I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Jason, it's been a pleasure, my friend. You stay safe, brother.
Thanks, man.